very kind about. The title of my talk, as you'll see why in a second, is called Wandering in the Dark. But just a few days ago, I got really excited because I realized something new about dark matter. And I'm going to tell you about that first. So I now know for certain that there are at least two kinds of dark matter in the universe. Okay? It's pretty amazing. You know, this is the first time I'm presenting these results. Let me show you the first kind. This is dark matter. This is the ultimate post-workout muscle growth accelerator, so maybe it has something to do with dark energy as well. But it's blueberry flavored. If you search for dark matter on Google Images, this is an ad that actually pops up. So. But what's really exciting is this one. This is Dark Matter Ale, which was a one-off brewing by the Brooklyn Brewing Company. I don't think we have this available at Pub Night later, but it would have been great if we did. Okay. So, seriously though, I'm gonna do a couple things in this talk in my limited time. So, I'm first going to sort of explain my philosophy on dark matter, and I'm sure you'll find that a lot of people in the same room share this philosophy, and that will perhaps go some ways to explaining a variety of different upcoming and recent dark matter projects that I've been thinking about. And let me first go ahead and just quickly advertise what I'm going to talk about today. So I'm definitely wandering around in the dark sector. So I will first talk about a model proposed a couple years ago that we're detailing the cosmology a bit more with my PhD student, Francis Cerecine, who is, by the way, graduating soon. So if you're looking for a fantastic PhD student to be your postdoc, this is the guy to hire. I'll then talk about some work on hidden sector models and what we can say about hidden sector models from cosmology. And then I'm advertising some other talks that, you know, coincidentally, there's some of my collaborators at the conference here. So, David Morrissey will be talking about some work called on a unified model for dark matter and baryons called hylogenesis, which has an exciting new signature called induced nucleon decay. Lexi, later today, will be talking about particle dark matter and strong lensing. And Adrian will be talking about a recent paper that just got accepted on dark matter perturbations before reheating. And there's a couple more, but this is only such a, you know, I only got limited time here, so please do come in and pick my brain on other things that are going on. So, what is my philosophy on dark matter? And I'm telling you this because I think this is the right philosophy to have on dark matter, and I know a bunch of you share the same philosophy. So let's start off with some poetry. So this is a poem called "The Unknown" by Donald Rumsfeld, which you're familiar with. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we know, we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Which, okay, it's actually gets to the core of, you know, logic or something, right? It's a fundamental truth, and it's been actually known for a long time. Of course, this is a quote from a Persian Tajik poet who lived in 1286, Ibn Yamin Fayyum Mahdi. This translation actually, I must admit, is direct from Wikipedia. So you'll see in a second how good Wikipedia is, but it basically goes through these possible states of knowledge. Okay, so either you don't know about something, and you don't know that you don't know, and then you're an ignorant man, and you're just going to be stuck, and you're going to be ignorant. You're not going to be able to make progress. If you know, but you know you don't know, okay, that's a pretty good situation to be in. You know, you're illiterate. You're not able to understand everything, but at least you know you don't understand it, and you have a chance of learning. A funny situation, which Rumsfeld didn't cover, is if you know, but you don't know that you know. So, you know, if there's, you're ignoring it, or it's, you know, there's just some misconception that's preventing you from knowing that you actually have this knowledge. And then, you know, at the top of the pyramid here, we have somebody who knows and knows that they know, and, you know, this is atomic physics of hydrogen or something. This is stuff that is in the textbooks. So I checked this quote, this translation with Nietzsche last night. And apparently it's not quite right. So apparently these two are okay, but this one actually says his horse of wisdom will reach the sky. Whereas if you know, but you know you don't know, then your limping mule will eventually get to you. So anyway, it's better to have a limping mule, and that's kind of my philosophy.
It's Wikipedia.
This is Wikipedia.
So did you change it?
Oh. I have not changed it yet.
Yeah, it's log on and change it right now.
Okay, so translating this into dark matter parlance, right? You know, we can say we don't know, but we know that we don't know. This means we are illiterate in dark matter physics, but at least we've thought about all the places that we should go look for dark matter and learn about it. And that's kind of where we'd like to hope we are right now, and if we're not, then we want to go fix that. So just very quickly, you know, my philosophy on dark matter is that we should expand our imagination as much as possible to ensure that we are not ignorant or unaware of possible physics that could be out there, and make sure that we are only illiterate. Make sure that we know where to look, we know how to learn about this, we know which experiments to build, and go and do them as to what extent possible, and, you know, go and figure out what dark matter is, with the caveat that, you know, there's lots of interesting stuff, as Neil was talking about earlier, that, you know, if we expand our imagination, we could actually already have evidence for dark matter right now, but we know, but we don't know. So that's kind of just something I want to throw out there, and I want to encourage you to expand your imagination. Okay, so what do we actually know about dark matter? Honestly, we know its abundance from the CMB because we understand atomic physics very well. We know that it doesn't have too much free streaming because we've measured the galaxy power spectrum. We know what the matter power spectrum looks like. And it doesn't have too big of a self-interaction because we have things like the bullet cluster that tell us that when dark matter, when two clusters smash to each other, the dark matter doesn't get stuck in the middle. it has a small interaction with atoms, otherwise we would mess up perturbations in the system. The other thing that, of course, we know is that it gravitates. And actually, this is very important to remember. This is the only way we know anything about dark matter, to be honest. We only know about dark matter through gravity. The CMB is gravity. Galaxy halos are gravity. So this is our tried and trusted friend when it comes to dark matter physics. And you can go into a space that's more crazy and more strange, and maybe that's what we eventually need to do. Right now, I'm going to stick with general relativity. And if you do that, then you can write down, you know, the most general action for dark matter. Right? So you've got gravity, you've got a standard model, which I'm calling the light sector here. You've got some kind of dark sector that dark matter lives in. You've got some kind of interaction between them. And this just captures what the space of possibilities can be. It's very big. But it's nice to think about it this way, because you can make a distinction between different ways of learning about the dark sector.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you have a microphone?
Oh, a microphone? No.
Sorry.
Okay, we'll start over.
That's funny to say.
So we
can have these direct signatures, these non-gravitational signatures that are just directly coupling standard model stuff to the dark sector, and then we can have stuff that goes through gravity, which, as I mentioned, is the only evidence we have for anything like dark matter at all. And I really like this comic cover. You know, dark matter physics, the way I think about it, is just adventures into something completely unknown, and that's why it's the most exciting thing to do in science. So what are the known unknowns? So this is just a list that I came up the top of my head last night at 11 p.m. But, how many components are there? Could it have weird gravity? What's the substructure distribution? What's the dark matter? How does the dark matter astronomy come in? Is there some sort of complex dastrophysics at play, small-scale interactions or something? Does it have self-interactions? Does it have hidden interactions, hidden gauge interactions? How does it connect to the standard model? You know, this is very important for determining how we can actually look for it. And of course, there's stuff here that I'm missing, because this is just my list, and we should take the intersection of my list and all of your lists and put it up somewhere so we really know what we don't know. And of course, and then there's the unknown unknowns, and this is just something we really have to work at to make sure we're not ignorant or unaware. I'll give you an example about this. So let's think of the ways we know to detect dark matter, right? We have direct detection, which, you know, usually means elastic scattering of dark matter off nucleons. It could mean if people have expanded their imagination recently into inelastic models, which is great. And we also have things like indirect detection, annihilation of dark matter into photons, neutrinos, and other scattered model stuff. But recently I've worked on two different projects which tell you different ways you could look for dark matter. You know, so there's another direct way that I'm advertising the talk by David Morrissey on Saturday is the destruction of nucleons by dark matter. We call this induced nucleon decay, and that's an unusual direct signature. And then there's another indirect signature, which is the gravitational scattering of photons off dark matter structures. And this is exciting stuff that Lexi Moussakis will be talking about later on today. Cut and paste, not your friend. Okay, so that's my philosophy. And let me quickly talk about a couple of projects that I've been working on. So this is Francis, and Francis has been thinking a lot about dark atoms recently. And what are dark atoms? Well, the nice thing about hydrogen is that we understand everything about hydrogen. Right? It's a proton, it's an electron, there's a U1 gauge force, you can calculate all the energy levels, 1922, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the simplest kind of atomic dark matter is just taking hydrogen and copying it and putting it into a hidden sector and letting yourself adjust the parameters of the interaction strength and the masses of the electron and the masses of the proton, and you get to play all the games that quantum physicists did in the 1920s, but now in your hidden sector. So you say that dark matter could be some kind of atomic bound state, and you have these protons, electrons, photons, and you say that today it has recombined, just as normal hydrogen, you know, initially did, into a neutral atom, and there's no long-range force because the universe is neutral. Now, if you're really worried about the long-range force, you can always give the dark photon a small mass or what have you through some Higgsing or something. But this is a viable model for dark matter. It basically has four free parameters: the fine structure constant of this dark sector, the binding energy of this state, the mass of the state, and also, in general, the temperature of the dark sector does not have to be the same temperature as the visible sector. Right? It can have a different thermal history. So this was originally discussed in papers by Kaplan et al. And there's been follow-ups on by Jay Wacker on supersymmetric dark atoms and various things like that. And so the point is, just like for baryons, in the very early universe, the dark matter was ionized, and it was coupled to the dark photon plasma, and you had this radiative plasma that supported acoustic oscillations. So you get dark matter acoustic oscillations, and this is the way you can look for this effect. So you can look at the matter power spectrum, and you can look for the effect of these acoustic oscillations in the dark plasma. So these acoustic oscillations occurred until sometime when the temperature of the dark sector fell below the binding energy standard sort of story, except for, you know, now all the coupling constants, etc., are free parameters, and you can solve for the ionization history of this dark plasma. Okay, so you do that, and we know how, if you know the ionization history of a plasma, we know how to calculate the linear perturbations in that in gory detail. Because that's what we do all the time, you know, every day when we calculate, you know, the CMB power spectrum with CMB fast or CAM or what have you. And so we can just do this. Now, before I show you what the result is, I will say that you have a much richer parameter space once you start playing around, messing around with the fundamental constants. So, region one here. So this is the temperature of the dark sector versus the binding energy. In region one, you have basically standard recombination as regular hydrogen, but in region two, the photons decouple from the ions before recombination happens, and that changes the recombination history. In region 3, Compton heating is inefficient, So you have a different temperature for the ions and the photons before recombination happens. In region 4, Compton heating is efficient, but it's just so weakly coupled that you have no recombination at all. And in this little sliver here, you just have no recombination and just pure adiabatic cooling. And so you can look at all the physics and revisit all the atomic physics, which is what Francis has been doing, in order to calculate things like this. Let's see if it goes. Things like this. Okay, so now you can calculate in gory detail, for instance, the matter power spectrum in this model, which looks like the standard matter power spectrum on large scales, and then here you have your baryon acoustic oscillations. But then at some scale, which depends on the recombination temperature of the hidden sector, you end up with dark matter acoustic oscillations. And importantly for observations, you end up with a cutoff. So the trick here is that, you know, now you have to redo everything that's normally done in CAM for all possible parameters of the atomic physics, and that's tricky. You have to set up, you know, better initial conditions. The tight coupling approximation occurs in different ways, and so this is what Francis has just about worked out and will be coming out in, you know, like in a month or less or something. Well, it's all worked out. It's just for writing the paper. Okay, so that's atomic dark matter. Yeah.
Changed the way how it scatters in a direct detection experiment because now we have more momentum kind of available, or
once it becomes a bound state and if the binding energy is very tightly bound,
yes,
then it's going to act almost the same as normal in the direct detection experiment. As long as you're not exciting the extra energy levels.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, if you have a bound state, you have momentum available due to the momentum on the orbit, so you could, I mean, if you scatter and you resolve the bound state.
If you resolve the bound state, then you can kick it up to excited levels and you have inelastic and etc. Right? It's
and also maybe transfer more energy. That's what I mean.
Yeah. You can kick it up to the higher energy, then you can have some excited atom, which then decays through a dark photon or something.
Can these atoms cool? I mean, do you have any trouble keeping the dark matter halo as a halo? I mean, you can emit dark radiation and attack momentum.
That's one of the constraints. So you have to. So now these are atomic states, and they could be excited. They could form molecules or something. You have to make sure that you're in a region of parameter space where that through collisions of two atoms randomly in a halo, you don't excite it and radiate it cool. So that's a constraint. Okay, so I've got a couple other things to talk about.
So I'm gonna, if you have questions on any particular thing, maybe we can talk about it at the end or after. Okay, so I'm going to quickly talk about some hidden sector work that I recently completed with Subinoy Das. And the idea here is that even if dark matter is in some hidden sector, we can still learn about it from cosmology, even if there's no interactions with the standard model at all. Okay, so let's talk about some motivation first. So we know WIMPs are, you know, a great candidate for dark matter because they satisfy the abundance. There's not too much free streaming. They have small self-interaction. And we have some parameter, the thermalized cross-section, to fiddle with so we can fit the data. We can get the right relic abundance in any particular model by adjusting this cross-section. Let's contrast this with the case of standard Moll neutrinos, so which used to be a dark matter candidate, you know, in ancient times. So the problem here is that they freeze out when they're relativistic, and their number density is huge, and it's just not possible to get this observed dark matter density. They would have to have a mass of 50 eV if they had hypothetically coupled before the QCD phase transition. Standard Moll neutrinos need a lower mass. This means they free stream too much. It also means that you violate the Tremaine-Gunn bound on the phase-based density of dark matter halos. You cannot have a 100 eV scale fermion act as dark matter, apparently. So, hot dark matter is not dark matter. It free streams too much. It doesn't match these things. But is there enough freedom? Can we introduce a new parameter into the model to fix this? And the answer is, of course, yes, if we shut off interactions with the standard model. So if we have a purely hidden sector that we only talk to gravitationally at the first approximation, then we can evade this constraint. There's lots of stuff has been done in hidden sectors. This is not an exhaustive list by any stretch of the imagination. But this is an interesting idea that we're just very, very tenuously, if at all, coupled to the dark sector. Can we learn anything about it? So I just want to go through this idea. So Feynman once said, and in his famous lecture on nanotechnology, that there's plenty of room at the bottom, which he implied that you can fit things at small scales. That's why we can have microelectronics and micro machines and what have you. And I advocate the Fourier transform of Feynman. There's plenty of room in the cold to fit particles at small momentum. Okay, and so what I mean by this is that if you have a hidden sector that's decoupled from the standard model, the temperature of the hidden sector can be small, and the energy density of stuff scales with a high power of the temperature. So you can fit lots of interesting physics into a hidden sector and still be compatible with standard model and cosmological constraints. How does this happen? The sort of the simplest thing you can imagine is that you just have different efficiencies for reheating into the hidden and standard model sector, and this just manifests itself as different thermal histories of the universe, and that gets stuck in. They never communicate with each other afterwards. So the idea is the parameter you have is you can play with the ratio of the hidden sector to the standard model temperature. This allows you to tune down the number density from this huge factor, and you can get away with particles that have a lower mass. So now you're able to fit this data. To get 0.11, you need a particle, if the hidden sector is 10 times colder than the standard model, that's about 40 keV, say. So the simplest thing you can do is you can imagine a hidden sector particle that freezes out when it's relativistic, just like standard Moll neutrinos. And the nice thing about that is you don't have to solve any equations or you just know the answer. So I call this hidden hot dark matter. It's hot in the hidden sector. To us, it looks like cold dark matter. It's non-relativistic today. It could be warm dark matter, depending on the mass and what have you. So you have cold heat. And this is a perfectly viable model of dark matter that fits all observations and has a free parameter, which is the free streaming length that depends on the mass and the temperature of the hidden sector. If you take this neutrino analogy seriously, then, you know, an easy thing to do is just imagine you have some equivalent of G Fermi in the hidden sector, and you can ask, and have some sort of hidden sector interactions, and ask what are the viable regions of parameter space in this hidden sector. And you get this region, so this is the mass of particle, you know, the dark matter, and something like a thermalized G Fermi interaction strength, so some dimensionful interaction strength. And you find that, you know, at very low masses, you're excluded. The top axis here is this temperature ratio. So at temperature ratio 1, you're excluded, but if you go to lower temperature ratios, you find this whole region of viable parameter space that you're allowed to put any model you want in as long as it has those properties. So this that's the simplest thing you can do. You can just imagine it's relativistic when it freezes out, no calculation required. The next simplest thing is you actually do the calculation. And this involves solving a Boltzmann equation for the relic abundance, just as you do in the WIMP case, but now you are allowing for the possibility that it could be relativistic or semi-relativistic when it freezes out. The only interesting regime actually is the semi-relativistic one, is because, you know, then you actually have to do things numerically. In the non-relativistic or the relativistic, you have good approximations. But we've done this, and we've solved this, and you find some, you know, numerical mapping for the relic density to the solutions to this equation. We've also considered constraints from the free streaming and the equivalent of the Tremaine gun bound, which, by, you know, it still applies even if it's a completely hidden sector particle. It doesn't matter. It's still the dynamics of collisionless particles is the dynamics of collisionless particles. It does not care if it happens to talk to us. So you get plots like this. And sort of you can go to higher masses, but I think the most interesting result that came out of this was that in the plane of cross section and this temperature ratio, you can make regions that are compatible with the dark matter density, and there's these cutoffs that come from free streaming or, you know, the Tremaine gun bound from dwarf galaxies, and this is for 10 keV. 3 keV and 1.5 keV, the color indicates whether it freezes out cold or warm or hot. So this is sort of cold freeze out, this is warmish freeze out, and this is hot. But you'll see this region here is getting smaller and smaller, and actually below 1.4 keV, there's no region. So this tells you that it's impossible to have dark matter with a mass that's less than 1.4 keV by purely gravitational constraints. We have no knowledge of what this hidden sector interaction is, but it's not possible based on current observations. With the caveat that at least it has to be thermal with itself in the hidden sector. Okay. So a couple more very short advertisements, and then we'll have coffee. So I mentioned that David is talking on Saturday. By the way, this is a good way to get extra time on your talk. Show the picture of the moderator. So we have this model called hylogenesis we came up with that. We came up with the word, well, we didn't come up with the word, but we cribbed the word from philosophy. It means primordial matter, the origin of primordial matter. After we came up with this paper, there was a whole bunch of follow-up papers with, like, various random Greek names for dark matter models. So I apologize for this trend, and I'm sure David will apologize on Saturday as well. Why did we come up with this model? Well, there's this problem in cosmology that I call the problem of five. And it's why in Earth is it that the dark matter to baryon ratio is five if they have completely unrelated physics? if baryons come from baryogenesis and dark matter is some kind of weak scale WIMP, which is, you know, the canonical picture that everyone's thinking about nowadays, then why should they have any sort of number density or energy density that's related? That's really weird. You know, it could be a coincidence. You know, it could just the you know the masses of particles sometimes just happen to have, you know, similar values even though they have physics that's completely unrelated. But maybe it's not. You know, maybe it's some sort of clue, and we should take this seriously. And we've been thinking about this, and a lot of people have been thinking about this recently as well. Can you relate the dark matter density to the baryon density in a coherent way, and make sense of this at a more fundamental level? And does that have any implications? So I'm going to just flash this quickly. David will go through this again and go through the physics on Saturday, I'm sure. But the idea we have is that we have some particle that couples to the neutron, which also couples to a hidden sector, and the dark matter in the hidden sector is endowed with negative baryon number. And if you have this, then you can have a scenario where baryogenesis and dark, you know, matter genesis happen at the same time, hylogenesis, and the baryon charge in the visible sector is balanced with the dark matter charge in the hidden sector. This is not a new idea. Larry Woodrow and Scott Dodelson had papers a long time ago with this very interesting idea. One thing that we think is new is that we realized if you have this, and dark matter carries anti-baryon number, then you can annihilate baryons and produce mesons. And this is this induced nucleon decay process that you might be able to see at, you know, for instance, Super K. So I will leave that as an advertisement. And just quickly wrap up by saying that I'm also interested in particle dark matter constraints from strong lensing, which Lexi will be talking about before dinner tonight. This is not an official logo, but again, the wonders of Google. So Lexi is PI of a team interested in this physics, and the basic idea is that in CDM theories, we know that the matter power spectrum goes out to very high K, but if you have alternative theories, there could be cutoffs depending on, you know, for various different kinds of dark matter physics, and by looking at strong lensing, you can probe that. So I'm intentionally being very vague because Lexi's going to go into this in a lot of detail. Okay, so early dinner. No, it's a little more complicated than that, and hopefully you'll appreciate how interesting this is after Lexi's talk. Okay, last but not least, dark matter perturbations before reheating with Adrian. This is the archive code. We're asking the question, how do dark matter perturbations evolve before and through reheating? And in the interest of getting to coffee, I'll just say that be here in 100 minutes and you will get the answer in more detail. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Questions?
We can talk at coffee.
So how about we reconvene at 11:30?
I guess coffee's upstairs.